Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. I want to thank you for listening to this podcast from Connecting Faith. There are many more podcasts available at our website, myfaithradio.com. And your support makes this possible.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Came across this headline today. Maybe you've seen it. Chicago saw its bloodiest month in two decades this August after police record a staggering 90 murders, 384 shootings, 472 total shooting victims. So far this year, the police in the Windy City have logged at least 468 murders and 2,848 shooting victims. We can't probably comprehend that kind of volume. In a major city in our country. We're going to talk today with a member of law enforcement. In fact, he's the sheriff of the second most populous county in the state of Minnesota, with 550,000 residents under his jurisdiction. And we're going to find out about what it means to be a police officer today. And there are some challenges with it, to be sure. Ted, I know, just came across some quotes. You think about what we're doing in our country today. Robert Kennedy said, every society gets the kind of criminal it deserves. And what is equally true is that every community gets the kind of law enforcement it insists on. Mm. And we've seen a lot of changes in law enforcement over the years.
And certainly. Yeah. And it's a hot topic now, of course. You know, we see it almost daily in the news with community relations and things like that. So we'll get into that and how we can be praying for the officers, too.
Look forward to that. I also came across a quote from Phil Robertson, which I thought was kind of interesting. You know, the Duck Dynasty guy. Mm-hmm. He said, you have to discipline your children or they won't respect you, law enforcement, or God, or anyone else. There may be there. We'll maybe get to that as well.
Yeah, okay. So,
all right. And then before we introduce our guest, just a final word. This is from a portion of the address given by President George W. Bush at the memorial service for the slain police officers in Dallas in July. Here's what he said. Every officer has accepted a calling that sets them apart. And most of us imagine, if the moment called for it, that we would risk our lives to protect a spouse or a child. Those wearing the uniform assume that risk for the safety of strangers. They and their families share the unspoken knowledge that each new day can bring new dangers. Mm. And he went on to give a very powerful speech, and we'll reflect on that in the moments ahead. Let me introduce our guest, and we'll just dive right in. Matt Bostrom took the oath of office as the 21st sheriff of Ramsey County in 2011, and he has been leading that county and that law enforcement agency, the second largest sheriff's office in the state of Minnesota, and with 550,000 residents in Ramsey County. And we have known Matt for a number of years and has a master's degree and actually working on more education. Matt, welcome back to Connecting Faith.
Great to be here, Neil. Thank you.
We always like to mention that you did some studying at Northwestern, too.
Absolutely. I actually finished studies, did accomplish the degree.
That sets you apart.
I did get the bachelor's done, so anything that happened after that, maybe we can point to Northwestern as putting me on a good educational course so that I could be successful in my future educational endeavors.
Well, we're glad to have you here. And you know, one of the things I was curious about, did you grow up wanting to be a police officer? Was that a dream that you had?
No, I didn't have that dream because I lived it. My father was a St. Paul police officer. And from my earliest years, I remember him coming home from work. I remember his partners and their families. And then later, my uncle, my dad's brother, joined the St. Paul Police Department. There was some point during freshman studies, I remember coming home and saying, hey, Dad, maybe I'll be a police officer someday. And he looks at me and he says, Matt, there's so many other jobs out here. So I really didn't give it much of another thought. As I finished high school, I did reasonably well in mathematics. And so, you know, at that time, it seems like a male kid that was decent in mathematics, I got tracked toward engineering. Actually, was studying at the University of Minnesota at the Institute of Technology. And I was going to transfer to more of a business program. I'd done some internships at 3M. And I thought, well, that's work I could do, but didn't quite seem where I was supposed to be. And when my dad saw me kind of fishtailing with my education, he said, you know, it'd be a good experience for you to get a civil service test under your belt. You should take this community service officer test with St. Paul. He says, they're never going to hire you, but it's going to be a good experience. Well, I did get hired. And as a community service officer, I really enjoyed the people I was working with. And lo and behold, that put me on track to test for the St. Paul police job. And I thought, well, the Lord will have me here for 5 years, and then, you know, he'll figure out what I need to be when I grow up. Along the way, I came back to Northwestern, wrapped up my four-year degree here. And along the way, here I am. Mm-hmm. That all started. That journey started when I was like 19 years old in 1981. Oh. Unbelievable. Here I am. And I'm like, well, so some 34, 35 years later, I'm still trying to figure out what I'm going to be when I grow up. And right now, I'm sheriff.
Okay. I'm just wondering if, you know, if kids still, you know, as you encounter maybe, you know, young kids around the fairs or whatever, do kids still want to grow up to be police officers? I mean, is it the same sort of interest today as it was 20 years ago?
I'm going to give that a little bit of a mix. I would say, you know, when I was a little guy, me and my buddies, the only police officer we knew probably was my dad. Mm-hmm. You didn't see police officers at parks. You didn't have a DARE program. You didn't have some of the community-oriented policing things. The police officers were out responding, and so it was a different feel. Not negative in any way, but now what I've seen, you know, through programs like DARE, Drug Abuse Resistance Education, or GREAT, Gang Resistance Education and Alternatives Training. There's those programs, but then there's been also the police athletic leagues. Mm-hmm. And then some Night to Unite got launched, National Night Out along the same line. So this community piece where families have an opportunity to interact with police officers when they're not in the midst of dealing with an emergency has changed. And there's more and more of those opportunities. So that part has changed. And so I think children being around police officers at an early age has changed. And not to mention, you know, right now, most schools, I would say, have a school resource officer. You know, so you've got a deputy or police officer in a school. So most kids growing up have had some contact with police officers at a time that would really been unusual for me to see that even in a school back in those days.
Yeah. And those are really good relationships.
They're very
too.
Positive.
Yeah. So that, which is one of the important things in terms of community relationships that are going on. Good. Mm-hmm. We're going to take a break early and then jump into some of the big questions, because I think I mentioned just the headlines out of Chicago. I want to get some of your reaction to that. Obviously, it was not that long ago that police officers lost their lives in Dallas, Minneapolis, and, you know, New Orleans both suffered, you know, police-involved shootings. I want to get some of your perspective on that as well. And we're glad to have Matt Bostrom in studio today so we can talk a little bit more about law enforcement today. Matt is the sheriff of Ramsey County in Minnesota, joining us today on Connecting Faith, and we'll continue in just a moment. Theme song from the movie Courageous, which is actually it's a great movie, one that if you're not seen, may want to just dig that out. I guess you don't actually go to video stores anymore, so I'm a little behind the times, but you could check that out. And we're also doing a little Facebook live conversation today as well, so welcome to those watching, checking us out as we talk with Matt Bostrom, who's the sheriff of Ramsey County, Minnesota. 550,000 residents in this second largest county in the state of Minnesota. Before that, he served as a member of the St. Paul Police Department for nearly 29 years, and he's also chair of Criminal Justice Coordinating Council, collaborating with countywide justice leaders so that justice can be provided to all. Matt, I'm interested in your reflection on, you know, the statistics out of Chicago are just hard to imagine. If you were the chief of police in Chicago, what could you do to stop or turn around the violence there? And, you know, out of that, are there some principles that we can apply in any other community?
You know, wouldn't it be great if I had that answer? you know, from a leadership perspective, you know, what you have to understand is it's taken a while to get to this point. Therefore, it's going to take a while to return to something us in a better place. Ultimately, anybody that does problem-solving analysis would determine, let's get to the core issue. And there's a variety of different social issues that have occurred simultaneously, independent streams, so to speak, that have converged and created what's being manifest as in this homicide rate. What's so sad is, you know, our country, I think, has done a good job honoring its veterans more recently, and particularly those that have paid the ultimate sacrifice. What we miss, though, is in that total fight of that we've had, cumulative soldiers lost, fighting for our freedom since the war on terrorism was announced in the United States, we will lose that number of African-American men in homicide in 1 year. And the weight of that on a daily basis is staggering. And so as law enforcement leaders, we discuss these things. We don't throw up our hands and say we can't do something. The question is, what should we be doing? What can we be doing? And so, one, you do things urgently. What are the things you can do in those neighborhoods to help even sometimes protect people from themselves? And I can talk about that in a minute. What are some of those things? And then the long-term thing, I think we have a responsibility as community leaders to highlight these things, and that every life matters. Every one of those that's a son, a daughter, a husband, a nephew, they have value. And so once we just kind of say, well, it's just another day in the city, we've really lost something as a society. And so as leaders, we got to remind people of that. I have to remind my staff of that. And so if I'm the chief or I'm the commissioner in Chicago, that becomes the daily pulse of the department, that all of these lives are valuable. They matter. They matter to these family members. They need to matter to us. So then getting community members to be involved in these conversations to say, all right, what are the things that are the driving forces that somehow this becomes an option on solving conflict, taking the life of another person? What are those things? And as a group, when we practice the true elements of community policing, what responsibility do each of us have to come together and to start working on our piece? Because that is, it's ultimately to get the rope tight, you have to take all of these different strands in order to fix this.
You mentioned community policing earlier this year, of course, the terrible tragedy of police officers in Dallas being killed, gunned down. The police chief said, you know, we expect law enforcement to do too much. You know, so we got a loose dog problem. We'll get the police to take care of it. Kids aren't doing well in school. Let's get the police to. So what does community policing look like maybe today? And what should it look like ideally?
Well, I'm going to come at that in a couple different ways. One, I agree with the chief. I think he's doing terrific work under extraordinarily difficult circumstances. So one, we have the opinion here in Ramsey County, and I would say the chiefs that also, you know, my department is the police department for 7 communities. There's 10 other cities that have their own police departments in Ramsey County. So our objectives is when people call and they say that they need a police officer to come and help them, we default and call, or we'll go on that call. We don't say, well, that's not a police matter. But Tank, frankly, when you get there, oftentimes it's not. It's a neighbor dispute. It's some other type of thing. Sadly, they couldn't think of any other solution but to call the police, which means they probably didn't know their neighbors that well or didn't feel comfortable enough going and saying, hey, you know, maybe I'll knock on the door first to see if I can work something out. And that's really, I think, what the chief is trying to get people to do is not just on National Night Out or Night to Unite. That's not the only night we should know something about our neighbors. I sometimes get asked at community meetings, you know, what can we do? And I said, you know, I say, become involved and know your neighbors. And they're like, well, I don't want to be a nosy neighbor. I said, well, I'm not suggesting that you be a nosy neighbor. There's a difference between an interested neighbor and a nosy neighbor. Mm-hmm. An interested neighbor knows enough about the families and the patterns and, you know, that if they need help carrying a bag of groceries in, that's what interested neighbors do for each other because they know and care about each other. The nosy neighbor is doing it just because they like gossip and they want to learn something. And so in communities that have interested neighbors, they're safe. Rarely call the police because bad guys physically can feel, I'm not welcome here. These people are all making eye contact with me. They might even be friendly. I don't like it here. They'll leave. I mean, so in a lot of ways, safe communities. And I know I've been talking for a few seconds, but I've got another.
Yeah,
I'm
no,
a cop.
Please,
I tell stories.
No, please tell. We want to hear stories.
Well, there's another piece of this that I think, you know, and I think to the listeners here at Faith, it's relevant that there's a correlation between safe neighborhoods and healthy churches. Hmm. Neighborhoods that have healthy churches don't have much crime. And I think sometimes as Christians, I wonder if we call the police too much for social issues as opposed to reinvesting in our neighborhoods. And what has happened with some of our large churches as they've grown in number and where do you get land? Well, you move further and further out into the suburbs. So what took the place of your previous church? What's there now? Where does that community walk to now? If they're in a crisis, time of crisis, and this is the time the Spirit prompts them to go to church, where do they have to go to now? And so my challenge to churches is that if you are one of those healthy churches that has taken that and gone to the suburbs, I want them to be a bit more spiritually introspective to say, you know what, it might be time for us to have a vision of multiplication of small churches in our communities, because that is what I've witnessed also over my career. Is the correlation between healthy churches and healthy communities. They really can be a tie that binds. And ultimately, I think if we talk about the tragedies and the value of human life, who is there better to continue to advocate on behalf of a community and remind them the importance of life and the meaning of life, but a healthy church in that neighborhood and a pastor that's active in that community?
Because once the church left, it became... The school became sort of the center of the community, and those are struggling as well, right? So we lost that spiritual input.
Huh? Yes. Yeah.
Matt, the challenge to be a interested neighbor, if we see something, I mean, we see the signs around the airports all the time, see something, say something. So mm-hmm. what do we say and when do we say it?
Great question. I suppose that's why you're the host.
Well, voice, I think you could do it, Matt. I think you should consider it.
One of the things that I would say to that is thanks, by the way, on the compliment, okay. I think. But most people, when they should call, they often don't. That's the odd part. Mm. You know, it's the kids are playing stickball or baseball in the middle of the street. They'll call on that. But there's a suspicious car that's parked halfway down the block they've never seen before. It's been there too long, and they don't recognize the occupants, and they're like, oh, I don't know if I should call on that. They've got it flipped. And that's really what when we say see something, say something, it's when you see the suspicious vehicle in your neighborhood, an odd place, odd time. There could be, I don't care how good your neighborhood policing is, there's no way the police officers can remember which vehicles belong in which driveways and which ones belong in front of your house or down the block. But the interested neighbors do. And by the way, you get God gives us a bit of it, and some people call it intuition, but we have an internal sense that something is not right. And I will tell you more than 95% of the time that's there by design, and that means something isn't right. And I appeal to people, call. It's one of the easiest things for a police officer or a deputy to check. Because you go, you get introduced to whoever it is. They might have a business there. They're from out of town. They're just waiting for their family. They got there early, and so they're just waiting for their family members to arrive. Perfect. And then there's other times that I've found in an alley, we end up finding out, looking in a window, and there's shopping bags in the car of marijuana. I mean, 11 bags, shopping bags in the old days when you used to get the large paper bags. Full of marijuana. Where did that come from? Just a suspicious vehicle sitting sideways, parked in a strange place in an alley, turned into that. So those are the places where we really do disrupt crime, is with those simple calls on suspicious behavior. And ultimately, when you do any of the, you pull that thread on terrorism, local terrorism, I mean, I don't want to scare people, but fundamentally, oftentimes the neighbors sense something was off, but they're like, oh, I don't want to be a bother, so I'm not going to call.
Well, of course, we have seen society shifting in its, I guess, what it expects from police officers by saying, we're not sure that we want you in the community because it seems like you're profiling or you're harassing. So talk about that.
Sure.
Say where you maybe don't come as much as you used to.
Well, one of the things that we're seeing statistically is that if a police department is practicing community policing and the neighbors are saying, wait a minute, you know, we feel like your traffic enforcement, your vehicle stops, it's, you know, you guys are way too stringent on that. Well, what we're seeing in a lot of our major cities is that with police officers are stopping fewer cars. Not because it's a work slowdown, but clearly they've heard the community saying they feel like we're being too strict. Well, in those cities where that data is, with the data that I've seen, disproportionately, violence now is at an incredibly high level. You know, recently in our sister city in Minneapolis, the last I saw on the north side, traffic stops were down, and the violent crime rate was up the first half of the year 19% from last year. Staggering. But I think that those numbers, you talked about the Chicago numbers. Now, I don't know about traffic stops and those things, but everything that I'm seeing is the pattern is holding. There's a correlation between the two. And so anyway, I just think for us, and I could tell a couple traffic stop stories, but
we'll save that till the second half, because that's the big payoff here. Yeah. People want to know about that. But, we got a couple minutes before the break. Body cameras, is that going to be the law of the land, the rule here soon?
Yeah, I know we were just talking about that during the break, and that will be one of those things. You know, when you see a police officer come up and they've got the bat belt on, right? Yeah. So we've got all, you know, the handcuffs, the taser, a pack set, you know, the radio, a smartphone. Body camera will be just part, I would say, in the next, for most major cities and even medium-sized cities throughout the country and smaller ones, I think that you will see body-worn cameras as part of the duty belt or at least the uniform. That'll just be part of what we do.
There are some downsides to that, though, aren't there?
Yeah, we had some challenges. You won't see those on my deputies yet, and it had a lot to do with the Minnesota state law. As far as data privacy, and one of those things is that because I'm a public agent, anywhere I go, therefore it becomes public by my arrival. So we're like, wait a minute, last time I checked the Constitution, when I cross somebody's threshold of their home, I need a warrant, probable cause, or something else. How in the world did everything that happened after that all of a sudden become public domain? And so we were hesitant to say, look, in people's deepest time of need, here I am videoing all of it, and a nosy neighbor could say, I want the public data. How is that in the public interest? And so we were looking for the legislature to do something that we apply all the time in law enforcement, and that's the cadence of good faith reasonable. And they did come up with an acknowledgement that, in fact, that should be the case, that if it is related to a crime, then that's contained like criminal data. And if it's private data inside that house, that's to the person that owns that house. And if they want to release it, they can, but it's theirs.
Matt Bostrom is sheriff of Ramsey County in Minnesota, joining us today here on Connecting Faith. He's been in law enforcement for, 30 plus, right?
Yes, amazing.
Long time.
Yeah.
No, long time.
30 plus. It's
sure.
Okay to say.
Yeah.
I started when I was 10.
Sure. All right. He's still looking good, though. And we're going to talk more with Matt in just a moment. In fact, we'll talk about what happens when there's a routine police stop. What does that actually look like and why? Maybe that you have a question. We'll open up the phone lines in the second half of the show. You can join us at 877-93-FAITH. That's 877-933-2484.
God is in control. We believe that His children will not be forsaken. God is in control. We will choose to remember and never be shaken.
Well, these are times when our nation has been shaken in many ways, and of late, of course, we've learned more about officer-involved shootings, which is something that has happened rarely, but it has happened much more, visibly now. And so we want to get some reflection on that today, as well as the life of a police officer. We're talking with a law enforcement leader today, Matt Bostrom, who has been sheriff for Ramsey County in Minnesota. It's the second largest county in the state, 550,000 residents. He's been that for the past 4 or 5 years. He's served in law enforcement for about 30 years before that. He's been involved in a variety of ways in terms of teaching and directing and leading and working in things like character-based police officer selection. We're going to talk about that in a moment. Just tell me during the break that Ramsey County alone gets over 1 million calls, and some of those are, you know, looking for maybe fire or other departments, but there's a lot of activity going on for the typical police officer. In the meantime, you know, you're trying to track down criminals, but you're also doing some routine stops. Tell me about a routine stop. What actually happens? What's going through the mind of your officers when they're making a routine stop?
Well, you know, a routine stop, one is, let me start with the serious side, and then I'll kind of talk about my personal experience when I come up to the window of a car and some of the reactions that I've received from those conversations are kind of interesting. At least I find them to be. You'll have to tell me if it's worthwhile to even tell the story. But anyway, so, you know, I think most people can put themselves in the mind of the police officer. You're walking up. You've seen, you know, in my case, it really was three strikes. If you make three driving mistakes in front of a marked car, you have to be stopped. I have to talk to you. That just tells you the level of how often you're stopping people. You stop so many cars for infractions. It's just the nature of it. People are kind of blind to their quality of their driving. Everyone else is a worse driver, sure. Just not them. But as you're going up, this is a stranger. You know, we don't know really anything about the car. You might be able to tell from behind how many occupants are in there. Very difficult to tell gender, race, any of those other types of things, even during daylight until you really get up to the car. So everything's kind of a tactical piece. It's measured as you make your way up, and then you begin your conversation with the person that's at the side of the car, you know, that you're at the window. And then that's where you have the dialogue on what you talk about at that traffic stop. So from a tactical standpoint, there's things that we do train, you know, what you watch for, what you look for, you know, as you make your way up to the vehicle, where to stand, where is a tactical advantage. So that somebody, if they did have something in mind for you, we make it very difficult for them that if they are going to get the first shot off, and often at a traffic stop, generally speaking, they will get the first shot off. The question is, am I in a position that they can do it accurately? And we train heavily for that. So that is a bit of a challenge. And then oftentimes, you know, most of the police departments around the country, you're alone. You know, you're the only one out there making that stop. And so, and we say it's a routine traffic stop. Well, I don't know if there is such a thing. It's not routine for the driver, and there's nothing routine. It seems like routine because you do it all the time, but each event is one that you have to be, what I'd say, hyper-vigilant, you know, not paranoid, but just vigilant as you make that encounter. And so a lot of times I think people wonder, why wasn't that officer or that trooper so friendly to me? Well, put yourself in their mind. They've never met you before. They've run into people that have been threatening in the past, and they don't know you. And so consequently, when humans are at that elevated rate, oftentimes you don't come off as Mr. Rogers. You know, it's one of those things we're working on, you know, as a profession, on how do you bridge that so that first encounter isn't quite as standoffish or robotic. But it does present a challenge because they're at such a heightened level of tactics as they make their way up to the car.
And I suppose location and time of day and, you know, all those kinds of things.
All of that plays into it. You're exactly right. I tell a couple stories?
Yeah. Right. Yeah, I'm ready.
All right. So, you know, in St. Paul, I was a police officer for a little over 10 years. Following that, I get promoted to sergeant and was a street supervisor for about 5 years. As you can imagine, I stopped a lot of people for driving infractions. And it was very interesting walking up to the windows. You know, there's time, you know, I walk up to the window and I have a conversation. I go along these lines and there'd be a woman that would be driving and she starts scolding me, you know, for pulling her over because she knows the reason I'm pulling her over is because she's female in a red car. Mm-hmm. Everybody knows
sure.
this. That's all you cops do. All right. Well, okay. I shrugged my shoulders. And I didn't even know how to defend myself against that because she said everybody knows this. I didn't, but she did. And then later you end up pulling somebody over and it's teenagers in the car and they start down the similar path. There, you cops. That's all you do is harass teenagers. That's why teenagers hate cops.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, then now you guys here we are, Caucasian males in the studio. You'll love this. So at least I still... And this is the one I've heard more frequently, going up, and it's a Caucasian guy driving the car. And he says, "You cops, it's all you do is stop white guys because you know that you won't stop anybody else because they'll complain." So the pattern continues that people are convinced the reason that they're stopped is because of what they look like. And I thought, where in the world does that come from? Now, I haven't done any analysis on this other than just kind of where does that come from? And what I believe is going on is that people are generally oblivious to the quality of their own driving. They see other bad drivers all the time, and they're like, man, that cop isn't stopping those horrible drivers. He's stopping me, and I'm not a bad driver. So it must be personal. So my question to those folks that think that they're doing it based on what you look like, I said, does that mean that when there's an oncoming car that's a police car, a trooper, a deputy, and they're driving right toward you and they get a really good look as you're going the opposite way, are you saying that when they're 100% sure they know who's driving that car and they know what you look like, are they pulling you over 100% of the time? Well, now they're silent. I said, so if you're saying the one time they can absolutely sure they know what they look like and they're profiling, that's when they don't stop you. The only time they do stop you is when they're behind you, when they're not sure who's driving the car. I'm confused. Well, anyway, so they usually I get a slow blink from people's hand. Sure. Well, okay, now I don't even know what to say to the sheriff on that one. But but it's something where we take our driving very personal. And then secondarily, you know, people get embarrassed. They're embarrassed that something happened. And of course, is when we're kids and get embarrassed, we lash out or we make excuses. Well, I'd love to say adults change a great deal from those times that we were kids, but in those moments, we kind of revert back to some of that. So consequently, you're being picked on, and it's just not fair. But ultimately, it goes back to people are not aware of the quality of their driving.
So when someone's pulled over, you know, we don't have to get out of the car and go back and talk to you, I guess, do we? That's, I mean, is there a protocol that we ought to know?
You know, I think the simplest thing to do is just answer the questions.
I mean, I'm hypothetically, because I can't imagine I'd ever be pulled over because my driving.
Because you're a wonderful driver. Yeah, of course you are.
It's not even going to happen.
Yeah.
So it's just trying to make something. Think of Ted, the producer. Right. Think of Ted. Yeah.
And Ted, after the show, we have been meaning I need to talk to you.
Yeah, great. All right.
But so. The thing that I would say to people is, one, don't be alarmed. There's probably a good explanation. And here's the other thing is if you know why you think, because sometimes officers will walk up and they'll say, hey, I'm Deputy Matt. Yeah. I'm pulling you over because, you know, you rolled through that stoplight back there. Is there a reason that you rolled through the stop sign? And then you give people a chance. Now, there's other times where they'll do kind of that customary movie style where they walk up and they say, you know, sir, do you know why I'm stopping you? I have to tell you, when somebody would actually tell me, you know what, I really don't know. I wasn't looking at my speedometer. I might have been speeding. That's refreshing because I'm thinking, well, one, either, you know, sometimes with that answer, I don't know why I'm stopping you. I thought, are you oblivious? You just did three violations in front of a marked car, and you can't pick one. You know, I don't want to be sarcastic. I never said that. That's in my mind. Or you're lying to me. You're either that oblivious or you're lying. In either case, you're really endearing yourself to the officer that you're talking to. So you'll find that just a little bit of honesty at that moment actually is probably going to cut you some slack. So from that standpoint, the other part is that put yourself in the shoes of the officer. What's in your hands? You know, and just let them rest on the steering wheel or rest on the windowsill or whatever those are. And they're just going to tell you what they need to verify your story. And it's going to be your driver's license. They'll need you to take that out of your wallet. You know, they'll need to look at that. They can't look at it through, you know, the acrylic or whatever that is on your wallet. And they're going to want to see proof of insurance in most states. Sometimes registration, they'll ask for that. That's not, we don't do that in Minnesota because that's known through the vehicle registration. But anyway, you do those types of things. Typically, they'll return to the car. They'll say, I'll be with you in a minute. They verify that information. And a percentage of the time, they'll return with a citation that documents what they saw. And then there's other times where they ask you to say, hey, you know, in the future, can you be a little bit more careful?
You talked about you train a lot for these situations, obviously, as a result of some of the officer-involved shootings. Recently, there was a lot of discussion. We need more training, better training, different training. What will that look like, or maybe what more could you be trained on?
You know, I think with humans, you know, you think about lifelong learners. You know, I think we talk about that just generally with in terms of our academic education. But I think as humans, continuing to refine. It doesn't if you're in ministry, radio, doing law enforcement, there's always something that you can do to get better at what you do. And I say, as a profession, if there comes a moment where you say, hey, we've got this nailed and we're going to spike the football, we don't need any more training on this because we got it dialed in, that is a problem. That's dangerous, actually. And so I think when I hear other law enforcement leaders talking about that, and even in our own staff, you know, I talked about some of the numbers, the volume of traffic stops that you have on an annual basis just in a county like mine, and the success that you have without any violent encounters or any use of force, no injuries, no nothing. So overwhelmingly, everything is working. But even my training staff said, you know, Sheriff, when was the last time we really sat down and talked to our staff about what we should be doing at our traffic stops? What does that look like? How are those conversations going? And when was the last time we really checked in to say, is there a better way to communicate with people so that they're more at ease? And then if they're at more ease, then the deputies will be more at ease and so on. And so all of a sudden you begin a nice cycle of positive outcomes. So, and I think other agencies, that's what they're looking at is all right, how do we deal with those transactions at the, and then the other side too, is when I say transactions, how much information can we get fast? So when you're walking up to the car, you know, you probably have a good idea who the driver is, at least the owner of the vehicle. You know whether they have warrants. You know the name of the, you know whether the vehicle's stolen or anything before you even get out of the car. So those are some technological things we're looking at doing because as quickly as you can get that information, the better it sits for everyone else. And so you go in knowing a lot more about the person that you're going to speak to in the car than just guessing. So anything that we can do technologically is another piece administratively we're working on.
Matt Bostrom is the sheriff of Ramsey County, some 550,000 residents in this large, it's actually the most compact, population within the state, isn't it?
Because mm-hmm. It's most densely populated.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, Matt has served in law enforcement for about 3 decades or so, and we're honored to have him with us in studio today. He's been involved in something called character-based police officer selection. We're going to talk a little bit about that. Also want to talk a little bit about the life, the family life of a police officer. And we'd invite you to join in. If you have a question or comment, you can call us at 877-933-2484, 877-93-FAITH. More with Matt Bostrom here talking law enforcement today in just a moment. At the outset of the program, that you know our law enforcement officers will run to danger when we run away, and they assume the risk of safety for strangers. That's we would do it for family members, loved ones, perhaps, but they do it for strangers. It is not an easy task, and we honor the men and women that wear the uniform. And glad to have Matt Bostrom in studio today to represent the law enforcement community. He's the 21st sheriff of Ramsey County, and is with us. Got 150 years or so of activity, right? In Ramsey County, I mean, it's a long history.
Right, Ramsey County would probably say we are Minnesota's first law enforcement agency. Mm. We were founded in 1849, and that was when Minnesota was designated as a territory. The first county established in the territory of Minnesota was Ramsey. So we do have a rich heritage.
Finding, the right person, I mean, that we started at the beginning of the show, do kids still want to become police officers? But you've been working on something for a while involved in character-based selection. Talk about that.
Yeah, it is something that really starts with a community conversation. And this is the true essence of community policing, and this goes back. This is a show in itself, but at least I get immersed in this. But one of the things that had occurred is that if you look back even 15, 16 years ago, this discussion about concerns about bias in policing or racial profiling, that was occurring in 2000. And the cities mentioned weren't Chicago, but they were, or Detroit or Baltimore. The cities mentioned then were the New Jersey State Police, Miami-Dade, and L.A. But it was the same conversation, the same concerns, and we were having the same things occur in St. Paul. Well, as a result of those seemingly distant things, the distancing between trust, between police and the community, we had a community conversation where we did a couple focus groups. And as a result of those focus groups, the long story there, but let me just suffice it to say that they came away with that direct saying, what we want the police department to do is to hire for character and train for competence. And the character traits, they actually came up with 15, but if you distill those and kind of order them, they kind of nest into four areas: trustworthiness, truthfulness, responsibility, and respectfulness. So trustworthy, truthful, responsible, respectful. And what the community was saying is, we don't think that you can make men and women have those character traits. So we want you to hire them and then train them to have those skills necessary to be an effective police officer. Wow, how do you go about doing that? So we started those discussions inside the St. Paul Police Department in my role as a training director and then later as assistant chief. But a couple things happened. One, 9/11. Which really shifted a lot of the work that needed to be done locally and nationally. Then the Republican National Convention came in 2008, but the planning began in 2006. So this never really got off the ground, but now that I've been able to be sheriff, this is where we started, saying I haven't forgotten about this community conversation. And beginning in 2011, that became the script that we would use on how we hire. First, looking for people that are trustworthy, truthful, responsible, and respectful. And we do that through our oral questions at an oral interview, and we look for that repetitively in our in their backgrounds, in their psychological profile. And if they make it through all of that, I'll just give you an example. Someone would say, well, how can you detect that in an oral interview? I'd say, well, we don't really ask the question, why do you want to be a deputy? Why do you want to become a police officer? We really ask the question, when was the last time you did something with someone who is less fortunate than you? What was the outcome? What did you learn? And it's very interesting where you run into candidates, what their answers are, and then you run into candidates that can give you two or three examples. Okay, we're getting some clues about their character. So when they arrive in the academy, I have, you know, you might say it's kind of an intense conversation, but I congratulate them on making it through the process thus far. And I acknowledge, I say, you are here because there's probable cause to believe that you're men and women of great character, particularly in the areas of trustworthiness, truthfulness, responsibility, and respectfulness. But you will only remain an employee of the Ramsey County Sheriff's Office and make it through probation if there's evidence beyond a reasonable doubt that you will be convicted of being a person of character. And as a result, the profile for these men and women, these people don't call in sick. They don't get injured because they keep themselves in great physical shape. they are cheerful, so they don't get complaints from the community. And the reverse side of this, overwhelmingly, the ratio of compliments that we get from these people that are the new hires, citizens for these people, overwhelmingly tend to be the people who are hired. Now, this isn't to take anything away from the staff that was already there, but what we're seeing is an incredible profile. And so while some agencies seem to be having issues where they're declining in trust and respect within the community, ours is disproportionately. We're moving in the other direction. And I would say people maybe can't put their finger on it, but I know what it is, and the employees at our department know what it is that the more we exhibit those four character traits, the more we become a stabilizing force in an otherwise chaotic world. And it's about being men and women of purpose, because ultimately, if you're a person of purpose, what are you characterized by? Trustworthy, truthful, responsible, respectful. And so what is one of those things? So again, to overcome these issues of trust and legitimacy, this is one of the things that we're having some great success with. And my recruitment is not a problem. We're getting some amazing people coming through the door. Good.
And may there be many more. That doesn't mean that the life of a police officer is an easy life. And say a word about the spouses and maybe the challenge. They don't wear the uniform, but they certainly wear all the emotions of it.
Yeah, it really is one of those things that in some ways, maybe it's easier to be the police officer than it is to be the spouse or the family member, you know, because you're the one that's out there and they're wondering what's happening to you. And you feel like, when you're out there working, you have the ability to kind of have some control or influence on your surroundings. And they're wondering the whole time you're gone, all that's on their mind. And, you know, I didn't realize it. I remember there was one time, and typically once I moved into administrative roles and I was assistant chief at St. Paul, one of the things we would go out in the summertime, take some of the pressure off, is we would go out and we'd start working calls. We'd pick up a shift or two a month. And my wife told me, as I'm putting my vest on, and because I'd been an administrator, I'd been wearing my vest, and she heard that Velcro, she said, my heart just sank. And she'd never told me that before, ever. So I'm thinking, wow, you know, this poor lady for 28 years has been carrying that. So, I, you know, as you can tell, I get a little choked up about it, but I'm like, wow, you know, what kind of husband misses that? But that was her strength. You know, when I came home, she was 100% supportive. I think if I knew she was worried about me at that level, I mean, I don't know how I would have done my job. I don't think I could have been effective. So a police officer's effectiveness then, in the end, really is proportional to the support that they're getting from their family, their friends, their church, and others. That ultimately is going to carry the day. And if they feel supported there, their effectiveness is going to be to the community, and everything else is going to be represented there.
You have chaplains within most organizations, but they're more to help with, I guess, the community, right? As opposed, are there internal ways that police officers can get support?
Yeah, and we've been continuing to grow our chaplain corps, and as we've grown that, I wanted it to kind of be kind of a coin. You know, one side is really to help with some of the community notifications, but the other side of that coin is to be that extra voice or person that we can. That they can have that conversation in the hallway with the deputy to say, how you doing today? And they, oh, I'm doing fine. And they can look them in the eye and say, no, wait a minute. How you really doing? And it is part of that support system that we've been putting together. And so our chaplains have been tremendous in helping being a stabilizing force for our community, but as well as our deputies and our staff.
You know, we live in you're a part of a long line of peace officers, but keeping the peace today in a culture focused on individual rights, that seems like a increasingly high mountain to climb.
You know, it is. You know, the a police officer's job, they sometimes think it's, you know, why do people do things? Well, fundamentally, people do things the way they do things because they're selfish. Why do they choose to drink to excess? Why do they lash out and hit somebody physically? Why do they say and do the things? Why do they take something that's not there? Our core fundamental police response is is due to the implications of personal selfishness. And the more we can get the kindergarten rules, right?
Sure.
You know, learning to share, give people the benefit of the doubt, share the toys in the sandbox. Amazing things would happen in our community if just could remember some of those simple kindergarten principles.
Starting to meddle again, Matt. But
say, yeah, I know. It's getting close to home. Sorry. That's my water.
Sure. Sorry. Oh, yes. All right. Okay. You can keep it then. Be that way. Had a great conversation today. And, Matt, we just pray God's blessing and protection on you and your whole team, and really for law enforcement around the country. Is there one thing that we ought to be praying for, our local constable or whatever level of officer they
are? Yeah, thank you for that. And my appeal is, pray according to 1 Timothy 2, verses 1 through 4. Any decision that I make that's positive isn't because I made that decision. It's because there were men and women that prayed according to those verses and that section of Scripture that gave me the wisdom to do the right thing because I was empowered through that. And so I invite people to continue to do that. So thanks.
Matt Bostrom, Sheriff of Ramsey County, Minnesota, joining us today here on Connecting Faith. Remember to pray for the police officers in your community, get to know them, and pray for their families as well. And remember 1 Timothy 2, 1 through 4. Had a great conversation today. If you missed part of it, you can always check it online. We post the interviews there so you can review them and pass them on to a friend. You go to the Connecting Faith show page at myfaithradio.com. That's Connecting Faith at myfaithradio.com. Matt, thank you so much for coming by today.
Thanks again for the opportunity to visit with you, Neil.
Listening to Faith Radio, hope that you'll join us again tomorrow here for another edition of Connecting Faith.